Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Financial Services Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, October 22, 2014, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call. Today, our telephone will feature a report on the latest happenings at the CFPB, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. My name is Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and also, we're recording the call for use as a podcast in the future. We have on our call with us today two panelists. We'll hear first from Jerry L. Lozier. He is of counsel at Winston & Strawn. He'll be followed in opening remarks by Professor Todd J. Zawicki. He is the Foundation Professor of Law at the George Mason University School of Law. Mr. Lozier is going to speak for about 15 minutes, and then Professor Zawicki will speak for 5 to 10 minutes or so. We're going to hear all about GAO data collection, Apple Pay, home mortgage requirements being revised, student loans, auto finance, and more. Towards the end of the call, we will be turning to our audience for questions, so please do be ready with your questions. With that, Mr. Lozier, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Dean. This is the fourth, I believe, monthly call we've had on developments at the CFPB. And as in the past, the Federalist Society CFPB Working Group has put together a list of developments in the last month at the CFPB covering, I think, September 10th to October 14th. And I believe that list is available on the Federalist Society website. This month's list has, I believe, 34 different developments. Our plan is to talk maybe about 10 of those developments. I'm going to talk about five, and I think Todd will talk about five. I'm going to focus on a couple of developments in the student loan area, a development in the indirect auto finance area, and then a couple of examples of what I might call your tax dollars at work. On student loans, first of all, on September 12th, the CFPB Student Loan Ombudsman Rohit Chopra spoke at an American Bar Association panel, and he complained that student loan borrowers and cosigners are making bad decisions because there's a lack of data available to them and a lack of transparency in what they can do. He urged that student loan borrowers be able to modify their loans more easily. And he even suggested that student loans may need to be modified even if they're not in default, because he suggested that default numbers understate the level of problems that students are having paying their loans, because oftentimes when a student is unable to pay, a cosigner will step in and make the payments even though the student is struggling. Finally, he complained, and this is something he's complained about in the past, that student loan servicers who service multiple loans for the same student repeatedly fail to follow the borrower instructions as to how payments should be applied to the various loans that are being serviced. More interesting, I think you'll find, is a speech given on the subject of the relationship between student loan debt and public service by the CFPB Director Richard Cordray, on September 23rd. He observed that student loan debt amounts to $1.2 trillion, which is second in the categories of consumer debt in our country to the amount of mortgages, home mortgage loans outstanding. He said that graduates burdened with student loan debt find themselves having to delay major purchases because they can't afford them, and that hurts the economy, of course. He estimated that 7 million student loan debtors are currently in default on over $100 billion in student loans. And he said that, of course, makes it hard for those 7 million graduates to pass background checks for jobs and to get home mortgage loans. And he pointed to a statistic that home ownership rates among younger people are down 15%. He suggested that student loan debt actually affects career choices of these graduates. And he said that, of course, idealistic young graduates often want to apply for public service jobs, but the amount of student loan debt they carry precludes their ability to accept low-paying jobs, which a lot of public service jobs are. And he went on to say many people of color work in public service, and he suggested that African-American graduates have nearly 15% more student debt than non-African-American graduates. And therefore, he applauded recent federal legislation that provides for student loan forgiveness for people going into public service work. Let me turn to something a little more practical, and that is some actions in the indirect auto loan area that the CFPB took on September 17th. On that date, they published a report on fair lending in the indirect auto loan market. And for those who don't know precisely what we mean by indirect auto lending, that's essentially cases in which you buy a car from a dealer, the dealer negotiates the terms of the loan, completes all the paperwork. You may think you're borrowing money from the dealer, but you probably know you're not. The loan is immediately sold or originated by firm, a lender in the business of making loans secured by automobiles. In March of 2013, the CFPB dropped a bombshell on that business when it issued a bulletin that suggested that illegal discrimination may arise where the auto dealer has discretion to set the interest rates on the loan. In other words, they found and suggested that where in those cases where the auto dealer can negotiate the interest rate, they found and believe that minorities are paying higher interest rates than non-minorities. In this report issued September 17th, the CFPB noted that in its examinations of banks, and in one single enforcement action against Ally Financial and Ally Bank, the CFPB has required banks and Ally to repay $136 million to 425,000 consumers who allegedly were discriminated against because of their race. The big issue in this area is an absence of hard, concrete data. In the home mortgage lending area, many of you may know, there's a statute called the Home Mortgage Disclosure Act that requires a mortgage lender to report to the federal government the applications it receives for home mortgage credit, the race of the applicant, sex of the applicant, income of the applicant, what happened with the application if it was rejected or approved, et cetera, et cetera. And in fact, the CFPB has proposed expanding the number of data fields on that HMDA reporting data. Well, that data can serve as prima facie evidence of a lender's possible racial discrimination in home mortgage lending. The problem is there is no similar data available in the automobile lending area. So also on September 17th, the CFPB released what it called a white paper, which explains its methodology for finding racial discrimination in auto lending. And the methodology is called, quote, Bayesian Improved Surname Geocoding, unquote, or BISG, which essentially uses a borrower's surname as a proxy for their race or ethnicity. In other words, the CFPB is enforcing in the auto lending area these anti-discrimination laws based on a person's last name. and concluding that if your last name is such and such, that you were a minority, and if you paid a higher interest rate, you were discriminated against because you were a minority. And of course, you may not even be a minority, but the geocoding system they're using may deem you to be a minority based on your last name. Finally, let me turn to some examples, a couple of examples of your tax dollars at work. For those who are sophisticated on CFPB funding, you may know the CFPB is not directly funded by taxpayer dollars. The CFPB is funded, according to statute, by a fixed percentage of the expenses of the Federal Reserve Board every year. But what people may not know who aren't students of this area, the Federal Reserve has an enormous income based on the huge portfolio of securities and bonds that it holds in order to control the money supply and affect the growth in the economy, and it buys and sells. And that portfolio of bonds and securities, of course, earns interest, and accordingly, and we're talking about trillions of dollars of bonds, and so the Federal Reserve earns an enormous amount of money every year. And what people may not know is that funds at the end of the year are paid to the U.S. Treasury General Fund and help to reduce the budget deficit. So indirectly, the costs of the CFPB are being funded by the taxpayer. So these two developed projects I'm about to describe are indirectly funded by taxpayer money. First, on September 25th, the CFPB announced a new research pilot project. They want to study the effectiveness of early intervention credit counseling for consumers at risk of defaulting on their credit cards. And their CFPB will be assisted in this by a large credit card issuer and a Philadelphia credit counseling firm. 4 days later, on September 29th, Director Cordray spoke to the Society for Financial Education and Professional Development. And in that speech, he expressed the view that our financial crisis was caused in part by a lack of financial education. So he therefore described a number of projects the CFPB has undertaken to educate consumers on financial matters. And he announced a new project. This new project will specifically examine, quote, what financial well-being means to consumers, unquote. First, the CFPB will develop, quote, a consumer-driven definition, unquote, of the term financial well-being. And then the CFPB will research, quote, key knowledge, skills, attitudes, and behaviors that contribute to individual financial well-being, unquote. And finally, the CFPB will develop a, quote, way to measure financial well-being, unquote. So that's our tax dollars at work. Those are some of the things that the CFPB has been up to in the last month. Todd?
Thanks, Jerry. I'm going to pick up with my favorite recurring topic, which is Operation Choke Point, which most of you will recognize from earlier calls, and which just keeps getting kind of more and more bizarre and more egregious. This week, a letter came out dated February 15, 2013, from the FDIC's regional office in Chicago, written to the board of directors of a bank that starts off, the FDIC continually assesses the risk and appropriateness of the business lines and activities of our supervised institutions. We have recently come aware of redacted banks' involvement in activities related to payday lending, specifically the processing of transactions on behalf of redacted. As a result, the FDIC and State of Ohio conducted a joint compliance and risk management visitation of your bank as of December 17, 2012. The focus of their visitation, they say, was the risk associated with this relationship and the effectiveness of board and senior management due diligence and oversight of this relationship in the corresponding payday lending related activities. And then they say, quote, it is our view that payday loans are costly and offer limited utility for consumers as compared to traditional loan products. Further, the redacted relationship carries a high degree of risk to the institution, including third-party reputational, compliance, and legal risk, which may expose the bank to individual and class actions by borrowers and local regulatory authorities. Consequently, we have generally found that activities related to payday lending are unacceptable for an insured depository institution. And what we see here is, of course, is the payday lending industry has brought a lawsuit against the CFPB, claiming that they were essentially doing, not against the CFPB, but against the FDIC and other regulators, claiming that they were doing exactly what the FDIC is doing here and has otherwise denied that they're doing. So this is, this is sort of moving closer to the smoking gun of what people have feared, which is that the FDIC is using vague threats and claims of reputational risk to basically try to hound payday lenders out of business. I think especially striking about this letter is the first paragraph, to me at least, where they say, as a result, it is precisely because of their awareness that that they were banking payday lenders, that's what triggered the inspection in this case. This is the first letter I've seen like this, which is a formal instruction as opposed to what's generally been more of a nudge-nudge, wink-wink sort of strong-arming of banks to get rid of payday lenders. As we know, it hasn't just been payday lenders. It's also been gun sellers and adult entertainment performers and others who have suddenly found their banking services cut off. And so I think this was a letter that came out this week that was released by House Financial Services Committee. Second thing I wanted to focus on was it came out in September, which had to do with Corinthian colleges. And it was a for-profit college that had been was run into regulatory trouble. What is interesting about this is that while the CFPB has looked at for-profit colleges previously, such as in their ITT investigation, that was a relatively narrow consent order. What's striking about the Corinthian College case is that the CFPB has clearly broadened their scope, which is that they're using sort of the tail of student loans to wag the dog of essentially regulating this entire industry. And basically, they're, in a nutshell, the argument of the CFPB is that attending a, in so many words, attending a for-profit proprietary career college is a bad investment, ergo borrowing money to do it is sort of inherently fraudulent because students shouldn't be going to these schools anyway. So they borrow money, and since there's no guarantee of a job on the back end, that means that essentially the entire business enterprise is fraudulent, in so many words, of what the CFPB is saying. Now, of course, unmentioned in the CFPB's report is that community colleges, for instance, have the same, if not higher, levels of student loan defaults. Community colleges even have a worse record of job placement for their graduates. Nevertheless, the CFPB has targeted this one particular industry to go after. And again, what is striking about it is that, unlike previous cases where the CFPB is largely, say in the ITT case, where it focused relatively narrowly on the structure of the loans in that case, the Corinthian College case is sort of a scattershot, sort of broad attack on everything Corinthian College did, using the angle of student loans, and in particular the company's private loan program, to essentially criticize and attack the entire business operations of Corinthian College, which is, of course, consistent with one of the things we've seen generally about the CFPB, which is that even though the CFPB's jurisdiction covers 99% of the world, They are covetous of that last 1%, including auto dealers and the entire operation of for-profit colleges. And they continue to expand their reach into things that quite clearly, as in the case of auto dealers, which by law are they are excluded from regulating, and as Jerry described, are again are using the indirect auto lenders is basically a mechanism for regulating auto dealers. Similarly here, what it looks like they're basically saying is that they claim the authority to essentially regulate the entire for-profit college industry through the lens of student loans. Notably, of course, that industry and the business itself has traditionally been under the jurisdiction of the Federal Trade Commission, who for many years has done that, has issued guidelines, has issued consumer protection cases involving cases of unfairness and deceptive practices, but now the CFPB seems to be gobbling that up as well, just as they have with the FTC's traditional and Dodd-Frank retained authority over auto dealers. Another big issue that came out was on September 22nd, the Government Accountability Office issued a very interesting report about the CFPB entitled, quote, "Some Privacy and Security Procedures for Data Collections should continue being enhanced." And what this is it was requested by the chairman of the Financial Services House Financial Services Committee, Jeb Hensarling, who basically said who has been concerned, as have many Republicans and others, about the copious amounts of data, just extraordinary amounts of data that the CFPB collects without any and is completely stonewalled any efforts to explain why they need so much data, what data they're collecting, and what they're doing with it. So because Congressman Hensarling said because the CFPB has not been willing to provide this information, the Congress instructed the GAO to look at this. And what they reported was that CFPB has undertaken 13 large data collection programs, including just one that collects information on 173 million mortgage loans, 75 million credit card accounts, and 40 million payday loans. Especially striking in the GAO report is that there are at least three data sets, including arbitration, deposit advance products, and payday loans, where the CFPB, where it contains information that directly identifies individuals. With respect to mortgages, credit cards, and other things, the CFPB has admitted, Director Cordray admitted before Congress that it would be possible perhaps to retrofit and to sort of reverse engineer from that data individual level information about consumers' credit cards and mortgages. And what the GAO found was that there were a number of places in which the CFPB has been wanting in terms of the security and the responsibility by which they handle this data. So, for instance, at least in one case, the GAO found that the CFPB unnecessarily retained sensitive data in two collections, but said that they were going to remove it in the future. The GAO found that CFPB has no written procedures and comprehensive documentation for a number of processes, that they have not fully implemented a number of privacy control things, and the like. Now, of course, the irony here is pretty rich in terms of a consumer protection agency that is taking somewhat less than fully rigorous steps to protect individual data. Added to that, as I'll just add one last interesting thing, is the CFPB, despite all this, still has not explained why they need to collect so much data. This came out in a hearing this spring where it was asked why is it necessary, for instance, for the CFPB to collect data on 900 million credit card accounts. Wouldn't say 100 million or 90 million be enough? Why 900 million? Why 85% of the credit card accounts and 90% of the mortgages? And in fact, Thomas Stratman from the Mercatus Center here at George Mason submitted a letter at that time where he estimated that the CFPB could get enough data to have sound sampling techniques at around 1% of the amount of data that they were currently collecting. And in other words, the CFPB seems to be collecting 70,000% more account-level data to carry out their regulatory purposes than would seem to be necessary. Given the threat to consumers from that, I think it still remains an interesting question, is why the CFPB feels compelled to collect so much data when there's an obvious risk to consumers and no obvious regulatory purpose for doing so. Congressman Hensarling had that, and then Senator Crapo in Forbes also called the CFPB to task for that. The final thing I will just note, many of you have probably already read it in the Wall Street Journal, which is that Mel Watt announced that with respect to housing finance, that basically we're going to go back to the good old days of 2006 and 2005 and start giving consumers mortgages with no down payment. That the remedy for it, because what has been observed is that while other consumer credit markets have to some extent recovered from the financial crisis and Dodd-Frank, certainly not all the way. Certainly, low-income consumers have been hurt very, very badly by regulations enacted since the financial crisis. The mortgage markets are still messed up. Most observers believe that that is related to regulations, qualified mortgages rule. Jamie Dimon has been very pointed about saying that it has to do with regulation and litigation risk, especially the risk of putbacks. Rather than addressing that, the government's response seems to be, we'll just encourage lenders to go back to making nothing down or 3% down mortgages rather than 20% down mortgages. Now, interestingly enough, when the qualified mortgages rule was announced, noticeably absent from that was a requirement of a substantial down payment. And so in some sense, they left wiggle room open for this. The irony, of course, is that the economic data makes very, very clear that the primary cause of the foreclosure crisis was not affordability problems in the whole, but instead the deterioration of down payment requirements, which is the Wall Street Journal in its editorial today correctly notes was the cause. As down payment requirements got smaller, when house prices fell, people were more likely to fall into negative equity, and basically people knowing a good investment and a bad investment walked away from their homes. And little known is that at the end of it, as we're sort of finishing up the foreclosure crisis, it remains the case that the largest single group of foreclosures were among prime fixed-rate mortgages. Not subprime mortgages, although that was the first year or so. Since that time, it's been prime mortgages, and the primary reason is because falling house prices leads people to walk away from their homes. The remedy for that is higher down payment requirements, and of course, that's exactly what the government is now starting to erode, or arguing should be eroded, would be down payment requirements, and essentially let the good times roll. Related to that, of course, is that low or no down payment requirements are the fuel for speculation, home flippers, and the like. And so that's sort of an open, welcome invitation to speculators to come back into the market, whether they are direct home flippers or whether they are people who are buying houses primarily for investment purposes. So with that, I've said my piece, and we can open it up to questions or comments.
Very good. Thank you both. Before we turn to the audience, let me check in with Jerry Loser, see if he has anything he wants to say to augment his opening remarks before we go to the audience. Jerry?
Thanks very much, Dean. The only thing I would say, I would comment on Todd's description of the data collection issues at the CFPB. When he mentioned Senator Crapo, I think it was Senator Crapo who, in the op-ed piece he wrote in Forbes magazine, said that the CFPB may be trying to out-NSA the NSA. So that would be worth hearing.
All right. Very good. Let's check in with the audience. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Once again, if you have a question, you need to push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are wide open while we're waiting to see if someone checks in with a question. Let me make a quick programming announcement. Our next scheduled Teleform conference call is Friday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. It's a special Courthouse Steps edition of Teleform. We're going to cover the Integrity Staffing Solutions, Inc. versus Busk case. It's a recently argued Supreme Court case about whether employee time exiting through a work facility security system is compensable. But today, of course, our topic is all things CFPB. If you have a question, our lines are open. Push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Maybe I can get things started here. You mentioned there at the very end sort of a CFPB-NSA comparison, and I'm wondering, where are the privacy groups on some of these new CFPB activities? The NSA and even private actors, Google and others, have taken a lot of criticism from pro-privacy groups for data collection or data exploitation or data sharing, even tracking. Have the privacy groups caught on yet to what's happening at CFPB? Are they engaged?
Can I just jump in, Todd? Before you answer that, I need to correct. I just checked my notes. It was not Senator Crapo. It was Congressman Hensarling, Jeb Hensarling from Texas, who made the comment about NSAing the NSA.
I've not heard anything from the privacy groups, and you know, and one can only speculate. But there seems to be, you know, there may be two things going on, right? Which is that a lot of the consumer privacy groups are big boosters of the CFPB, and you know, maybe it's one of these things where they are simply circling the wagons and don't want to criticize the CFPB. Maybe they really are just asleep at the switch. Maybe they don't realize this, which seems hard to believe considering that I think the Republicans have been pretty good at promoting these questions. And really, when Director Cordray was asked back in the spring, why do you need to collect so much data, his response was completely unsatisfying, which is, he said something like, if you ask 10 different economists, you'll get 10 different answers. Well, that's not really an answer to the question, which is, why do you need to collect so much data on consumers when it seems so obvious that you don't need to collect it? Another thing, of course, is that it's not just a mission thing where privacy groups may be supporting the CFPB. There hasn't been a lot of oversight. I'm not even quite sure what's going on with it. But, of course, the CFPB has this huge slush fund that they can hand out to interest groups, to research groups, things like that, basically for research advocacy or whatever the case may be. It may be worthwhile for somebody at some point to try to find out where that money from that slush fund has been going, and to what extent is it going to groups that primarily their primary job is to boost the CFPB and its mission.
Once again, if you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone, and I will ask another question. There seems to be quite a bit of criticism of the CFPB on this call and in the popular press. Is there any indication that the criticism is having an effect on the CFPB and what they would do or not do? This month's report that Jerry Lozier mentioned has, I think, 34 undertakings of the CFPB in the past month. Might that have been 64 if there hadn't been previous criticism of the CFPB, or are they just plowing ahead and maybe paying more attention to praise they might be receiving from other quarters?
Jerry, do you have any thoughts?
I'd be the first one, I think, to detect running wild at the CFPB. I really think I would. I've got to say, I think there is a very sincerely held belief there that they are not just doing the right thing, but if you listen to the speeches, there's some interesting points they make. One that I don't think we've ever discussed on this call that you hear repeatedly from Director Cordray is that in the case of consumer credit, you have three forces, I hope I can remember all three, that have enormous effects on consumers, but consumers have no market ability to affect them. And they one is the servicing the servicers who are supposed to, you know, listen to requests for loan modification, but the servicers are not chosen by the consumers; they're chosen by the lenders, and so and the investors. And so, as a consequence, there's no incentive for the servicers to be responsive in a market type of way to consumer requests. Same with debt collectors. Debt collectors are chosen by the lenders and are responsive to them, not to the consumers they're dealing with. And there's a third category I'm blanking on. It's just an example. I mean, these are sort of good faith, true believers over there. And I don't know that they're responsive to a lot of this criticism, because I think they have the rightest belief that they believe in their cause over there.
There's been a lot written on the fact that CFPB is essentially been staffed with activists, not with people
Absolutely.
Who have experience in this industry. The Washington Post, of course, did a very prominent piece on this, of the early stand-up of the agency, and basically how people with experience, people with judgment, have been driven out, and political activists whose primary concern or primary background consists of having worked on the Obama campaign have become very senior and influential people at the agency. I think that's definitely part of it. I think, but more generally, there's no indication over time that the CFPB, for instance, has decided to become more cooperative with Congress. As we noted, mm-hmm. the reason why this GAO report was done was because Congress, the CFPB was unwilling to provide Congress with any information about what they were collecting, why they were collecting it, what they were doing with the data they were collecting, and that sort of thing. And so the practice of stonewalling Congress, they clearly feel like they have no obligation to cooperate with Congress, and that's exactly the way the agency is set up, right? With Congress having no budgetary stick right. over the CFPB. That's primarily how traditionally Congress can get answers out of agencies. I think an issue to watch is this continuing saga of the indirect auto lending. And it's been somewhat surprising to me that given the clear statement in Dodd-Frank, the CFPB is not permitted to regulate auto dealers, CFPB has nonetheless continued forward with turning banks and indirect auto lenders basically into a regulatory arm of the government to essentially regulate auto dealers. I've been somewhat surprised that they've continued with this extraordinary initiative that Jerry described of basically using geocoding and that sort of thing, and so pushing forward with a disparate impact approach to this question, which seems extraordinarily far-fetched in this situation, considering again that the indirect lenders collect no demographic information and they're actually required now to use this proxy evidence as to whether a particular surname may be associated with a particular race. Where they've stopped short so far, but perhaps one thing to look at is the CFPB for a while has been making noise that they want to impose a flat fee compensation system on auto dealers. Mm-hmm. Something like this has proved to be a disaster when it comes to mortgage brokers, and one of the reasons why low-income consumers can't get mortgage loans anymore is because they've changed the compensation so the mortgage brokers have no incentive to help those consumers. One suspects that if the CFPB foists flat fee compensation on auto dealers and places of loan, that you'll have all kind of unintended consequences. It'll disrupt the auto, not just the auto lending, but auto markets. But I think the fact that they're steamrolling forward with disparate impact, and something to watch then is if they actually do try to remake the entire auto industry in America through this lens of basically how they allow compensation for loans. That looks like a pretty far step. So far, they haven't been shy about infringing on other industries that are supposed to be beyond their purview, but that might be something to watch.
Can I just underline something Todd said? He's right on the money, as always, when he points out in this auto dealer lending area, The one thing he did not mention is there has been a lot of congressional pressure on the CFPB in this area, questioning the rationality of it and the basis for these beliefs that, you know, if a dealer can affect the interest rate, there's going to be racial discrimination. And the CFPB has just pushed back and refused to pull back in this area. So that's sort of responsive to your question, that the CFPB does not seem to be getting the message clearly in this auto lending area. And by the way, Dean, I remembered the third non-market-driven force that is out there in consumer credit that the CFPB is concerned about, and that's credit reporting agencies, again, that have enormous effects on consumers. Consumers try to correct misinformation the credit reporting agencies have, but the credit reporting agencies have no privity with those consumers. They only, you know, they deal with lenders, and so the poor consumer has no ability in a free market to affect the conduct of these credit reporting agencies that affect the consumers.
Right. You don't get to pick your own debt collector, and you don't get to pick your own credit reporter. So you're not allowed to tell them, only report good stuff about me.
Right. And you cannot pick your own debt servicer as a third party.
Right. Mortgage servicer. Right.
Yeah. So that's the theory from which the CFPB is operating.
It's true, yes.
We do have two people in our audience now with questions, so let's take a call here.
Hello, Jerry and Todd. Excellent summary of the latest developments at the Bureau. I noticed that your list keeps getting longer every month. the question that I want to raise here brings two of your comments together, I think, and that is, one, I think the comment that Todd was making about this slush fund, or these funds that the Bureau collects as part of the fines that it imposes on malefactors that it identifies, and bringing in the indirect auto lending and the very imperfect means of identifying the protected minority groups that are supposed to have been harmed in some of the indirect auto lending. So if they get a firm that cops a plea, to get the Bureau out of their hair, and they're willing to pay a fine to the Bureau, and some of that fine is supposed to go to recompense offended parties, given that they have a very imperfect means of identifying who those parties are, is it possible that some of the beneficiaries of these reimbursals from the fines and all will actually be majority individuals, not protected minorities at all?
Absolutely. Wayne, I recognize that's Wayne Abernathy from the American Bankers Association, who probably should have been on this panel. It's funny you asked that, Wayne, because I thought about that yesterday, and that's I'm sure that's exactly right. It's going to people with names, whose names under their Bayesian technology they believe are minorities, but they may not be minorities at all.
Yeah. I think of, for example, the name Martin, which is a well-known Spanish name, or Martin, a well-known Northern European name. You know, you happen to live in a Hispanic neighborhood, you're Hispanic, you're going to get a benefit for being discriminated against, whether or not that happened, it seems to me.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's the nature of disparate impact, right, is you don't have to actually show somebody was actually discriminated against.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much. I thought that was the case, but appreciate your comments, and excellent program today.
Right. Three questions pending now, so let's take another caller question here.
Hi, Larry Callahan. I put on my mic because there didn't seem to be anyone else. I have a couple of comments. One, the name Callahan, I guess I'm not going to be able to fire a comment.
You're going to have trouble. Huh?
The other is just kind of noting my availability. If they are trying to define financial well-being, I'd like to note that I am retired at Berkeley. I took graduate courses and in economics. I took courses in psychology and law school. I studied banking, later worked in the banking, worked both defending people in physics cases, working for banks and other such things. So I think I'd fit well on that committee, so any suggestions you might have would be appreciated. But more importantly, and that has to do with the student loan issues, and just a question, because I don't follow what's going on there, but when I took out student loans both for law school and as an undergrad, I know at the time they were sometimes called national defense loans. At the time, if you went into the military, which I did, part of those loans were forgiven. Part of them were also guaranteed. And it wasn't only in the military. If you went into the Peace Corps, so I would assume that might now, if they still had it, would be both the Job Corps or the Peace Corps, similar things, a certain percentage was forgiven. Do the student loans now have those kind of terms, either with regard to military or kind of service in the community, like the Peace Corps or the Job Corps?
It does, Larry. And the key move was a few years ago. I believe it was part of it was either stimulus or Obamacare. Included the provision for the federal government to take over the student loan market. And it was fairly clear to me at the time. It's become more clear since then that a primary purpose for that was social engineering, which is that built into that was loan forgiveness provisions for people who, say, hypothetically were to take an occupation, say, as a community organizer, as opposed to working in the private sector. What we saw basically on the day of passage, the next day, basically, Democrats started introducing legislation to expand those forgiveness programs to allow to make it easier for people to get out of it. They've expanded more and more over time loan forgiveness, and essentially that's kind of what that is. It's kind of turned into the government has politicized it and kind of turned it into a form of social engineering to reward people who go into certain occupations rather than others. Of course, it's also been an under the radar sort of from the beginning Occupy Wall Street sort of salve to college students who decided that they had to go to private universities rather than a state university, for instance, the CFPB's kind of been running a lot of this under the radar sort of political pandering to interest groups, sort of Occupy Wall Street type college students. And so a lot of this is rhetorical, and it ties in with the government's takeover of student loans. And so there's really sort of a comprehensive sort of strategy, I think, going on here.
Yeah, I would note that in those days, in the 70s, there wasn't forgiveness. There was one, it was from a bank, a financial institution, and a certain percentage, it's certainly under 15%, maybe like 10% right, or something, was paid by the government. So, it sure helped, and it's better than a kick in the pants, but it certainly wasn't a total loan forgiveness or anything of that
right
sort. But I guess
things are changing.
Thing.
Yeah, right. I mean, the other thing to remember, of course, is from a purely political perspective, higher education in America is one of the biggest, if not the biggest, industry, along with government employees. Higher education is a very substantial political constituency of the Democratic Party. The single largest employer in terms of donations to President Obama's reelection campaign was the University of California university system. Harvard University was third. There's huge amounts of money in higher education, and higher education today, the whole bubble is basically built upon this edifice of cheap student loans. And so a lot of what this is essentially a bailout and a propping up of a very politically powerful industry for the Democratic Party. And so this fuel of very cheap student loans and the like is tied in with that as well.
Well, now I feel much better about not donating recently to UC Berkeley.
We've still got a couple questions pending. If you'd like to join the queue, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our next caller.
Hi, this is David Kovic from Wolverine Trading. I want to thank the panelists for a very informative presentation. I have one question. I don't understand why there's such religious opposition from the Democrats on the Hill to turning the CFPB into a commission. Can you give us some insight on that?
Sure. It's exactly for the reasons that we were saying in response to Dean's question, which is that the Democrats want a politically unaccountable CFPB. The reason it was set up the way it was, with a director appointed for a 5-year term, not removable by the president, the reason it's insulated from budgetary oversight, the reason it's not a commission, is precisely because what they wanted to do was stand up this agency right in the wake of the financial crisis, put in a director, which originally was slated to be Elizabeth Warren, who would basically build out the agency and essentially structure, staff the agency with activists and an unaccountable director, and basically get it off to a running start so that Republicans in Congress couldn't do anything to undo it. And even if a Republican was president, was appointed, wouldn't even be able to put his own director in there. So, and that's essentially what they've done, right? Which is they've basically just run as far as they can, as fast as they can, to try to entrench the things that they're doing, to pass as many regulations as possible, to go after many industries as possible, and try to basically create a momentum behind the agency. Now, if a Republican were elected president and Republicans took the House and Senate, my guess is you would find Democrats to be much more amenable to the idea of a bipartisan agency at that point.
You're so
One question pending at this point. Again, if you have a question, we've got about 9 or 10 minutes left. Push the star button and the pound button on your telephone, but let's head now for what looks like the last question.
Hi, this is Tony Cotto in Washington, D.C. with the NAIC. I noticed in the news clips that last Friday, President Obama issued an executive order, I guess, calling it the Buy Secure Initiative, about data breaches and credit card technology and payment processing terminals. So I'm wondering if either of the panelists on the call have any thoughts on this, or see sort of the CFPB in the efforts to implement getting into other aspects of financial services, and the way, just go to the heart of the way payments are processed across the industry.
That's a great question, Tony, and I have not looked at that question. It did prompt one thing that I forgot to mention in my remarks, which I think are related to your point, which is my friend Adam Levitin, who teaches at Georgetown Law School, did an interesting post on his blog addressing the question of whether Apple Pay, for instance, you know, the new technology coming out from Apple, whether they would be subject to the CFPB, and the answer is probably yes, you know, which is good in some sense because, you know, because they don't deserve to, you know, everybody deserves to have the pain of the CFPB. No, I'm kidding. But it could be reaching into these sorts of things, and whether it's the issue you're talking about, which is obviously we've got a lot of entities working hand in hand, you know, the FDIC, the Treasury, and the DOJ are behind Operation Choke Point, the things that you're talking about, could, you know, originate, as you said, from places on the CFPB. But I think it'll be an interesting thing to watch whether, you know, what happens with Apple Pay and the regulatory state, and to what extent does regulation essentially allow itself to adapt to Apple Pay, or to what extent do they try to, you know, jam a square peg in a round hole. You know, traditionally, CFPB picks on politically unpopular groups. Washington picks on politically unpopular groups and let others get a free pass. For instance, PayPal somewhat surprisingly managed to avoid getting sucked into the Durbin Amendment's interchange fee price controls, even though a pretty strong case could have been made that PayPal should have been covered by the Durbin Amendment's interchange fee price controls. So a lot of times what you get are these conflicts between you know, popular groups where they back off, and others that they go after. I haven't looked at the details of the credit card data breach points that you raise, Tony, but I will look at that. I'd be interested in your thoughts, if you wanted to respond, as to what you see going on there.
Honestly, I'm just kind of wondering if this is another area of sort of mission creep, where we're going to start seeing the CFPB regulating all financial products.
Todd, can I jump in here? I actually have looked at this a little bit on behalf of a client. There is a huge misconception going on And Tony, you may be subject to it. The president's executive order is only limited to those cards, credit cards and debit cards, that are used to implement federal payments. So people who do not have bank accounts and receive Social Security receive debit cards under a program called Direct Express, issued by Comerica Bank. And so the president's executive order is essentially codifying, to be honest with you, what Comerica Bank has, I believe, already agreed to. They've renewed that contract, which, and it's effective January 1 of 2015, and they've agreed to reissue the cards as, a chip and pin cards rather than the magnetic stripe cards. But I know we have credit card issuer clients that thought, oh my gosh, the president's mandating that all credit cards be chip and pin credit cards, and that's not what's really covered by the executive order.
Great, that's very helpful.
Yeah.
Let me make one last final call for questions. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Looks like you gentlemen have exhausted the audience. Let me give you each a chance to express any final thoughts and just remind folks generally on the call that we'll host another one of these calls in the next month. But Jerry Lozier, final thought?
I just want to thank Todd for doing this. I just enjoyed listening to Todd, and he's so articulate and so sophisticated in his insights into what's going on at the CFPB. I always enjoyed listening to him.
Yeah. Professor Zwicky.
Well, Jerry, I would just say keep an eye. It'll be interesting to see what happens with this down payment requirements on mortgages. There seems to be a growing appreciation that the mortgage market is still not functioning correctly. It'll be interesting to see whether at some point the administration learns the lesson. A lot of this has to do with primarily their regulatory and litigation approaches, and essentially reheating the bubble is not going to be the long-term response to that. So I would urge listeners to kind of keep an eye on that on the Wall Street Journal and see if this starts to take programmatic form to try to heat up the mortgage market without actually going to the root of the problem, which is the litigation and regulation risk that they've created.
Dean, can I add one last thing to a thought that Tony might be interested in? And that is, I know he's asking, might the CFPB get involved in this? And I've got to point out another very obscure thing in the Dodd-Frank Act, but the authority of the CFPB over customer privacy only extends to prohibitions against the sharing of information. There's another provision in the law dealing with information security, and the CFPB does not have jurisdiction over that section. That section remains back at the banking agencies and the Federal Trade Commission, the state insurance commissioners. The CFPB does not have authority over information security, so it could not follow up, even if President Obama's executive order applied to all cards, which it doesn't. That would not authorize the CFPB to get into this area. They only can get into
just
sharing.
Because they're not authorized doesn't mean they wouldn't get into it, though.
You're so cynical, Professor.
I think they've proven that already.
Thank on behalf of the Federalist Society both Professor Zwicky and Jerry Lozier. We certainly appreciate the rather Herculean task of distilling everything that's going on at the CFPB on a monthly basis as you do. I want to thank the audience as well for joining us today. A reminder that our next scheduled Teleforum conference call is a Courthouse Steps edition of Teleforum on Friday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.